great. Well, welcome, everybody. Welcome to the April Citizens Climate Lobby call. For anybody who's participating in Easter or Passover this weekend, I hope everything goes great with that. Before we get into the call, I'd like to welcome the new chapters that started since last month's call. So that includes the Woodlands in Texas, Bakersfield, California, Southeast Tri-City Counties, Michigan, Long Island East, New York, Vallejo, California, Port Charlotte, Florida, Birchwood, Wisconsin, Mid-Hudson Valley, New York, North Manitoba, Canada, Kirkland, Washington, and Indianapolis, Indiana. So for those of you in those new cities, congratulations. So great to have you aboard. What happens on this call every month is in just a couple of minutes, I'll be introducing our speaker, George Marshall, who I have a lot of people recommend a lot of books to me about dealing with climate change. This is the book that has been recommended to me by far the most, and he's in Great Britain this evening, so we're particularly fortunate we could have him on a Saturday night in Great Britain, and so he'll be speaking in a few minutes. After that, we'll go over some of the things that's happened since last month's call. And then this month's actions, the actions we take every month are important. This month's actions are particularly important, so I'd like you to make sure that you stay on for the very last bit of the call when we review the things we'll be doing in the U.S. and Canada. Now, usually before I introduce our speaker, I like to tell our speaker a little bit about CCL Volunteers. And I got an email from one of the volunteers yesterday that actually explains the organization we're trying to be better than I could. So I want to read everybody a short email from Jay Butera. He said, "Hi, Mark. Yesterday I met with Lauren Remy, our new contact at Senator Marco Rubio's D.C. office. As you know, despite the senator's high-profile opposition to climate action, we continue to maintain a cordial relationship with his D.C. office. I started the meeting following the CCL principles of appreciation and respect, but when I had finished explaining why our Schultz-Becker carbon fee and dividend plan is the conservative way to reduce climate risk, Lauren paused the conversation. She looked at me and asked, 'And just how do you expect to move this bill through this Congress?' And of course, at that moment, the CCL parable of Gandhi and General Smuts flashed and played in my head. I've heard and told the story so many times, and there it was happening live. So before I knew it, I had said the answer we all know so well, 'With your help,' I told her. Lauren was totally taken aback by this. She laughed, and then she asked me, 'And who in this Senate do you think is going to introduce this bill?' Try my best to channel Gandhi, Marshall, and all of CCL. I told her, 'We think Senator Rubio will introduce the bill.' And at that moment when I was saying that, I truly believed it to be possible. And I even think Lauren herself believed it to be possible, at least for a moment. You know, she said, 'I'm not sure that's going to happen right now, but I really admire your confidence and positive attitude.' We laughed about it, continued to have a great conversation, and she asked if I would come back next month to continue the dialogue." Jay Butera, that's just as pure of what we're trying to do as an organization as I can even imagine. Okay. Our speaker, George Marshall, is the founder of the Climate Outreach and Information Network based in Oxford, England. And over the past 25 years, he's worked at all levels of environmental movement, including senior positions for Greenpeace USA and the Rainforest Foundation. He's one of the leading European experts on climate change communication, is a lead advisor to the Welsh government, and counts major environmental organizations, politicians, faith groups, businesses, and trade unions among his clients. The book that we're particularly interested in, and George can speak about whatever he wants to, but the book everybody's been recommending to me is Don't Even Think About It, Why Are Our Brains Wired to Ignore Climate Change? So, George Marshall, I'm glad we were able to figure out the right time zone, get you on the call, and we'd love to hear you talk about some of the things in the book that would be important to us. Welcome.
Well, thank you so much for having me on the call, and can I say I have huge respect for you as an organization or what you're trying to achieve. I met when I was traveling around the States promoting the book. Everywhere I went, people from Citizens Climate Lobby appeared, and they always had something interesting to say, and there was this enormous enthusiasm. So I know some of you are sitting in groups. You know, take the time to congratulate each other for the great work you're doing, because I genuinely respect and admire it. I'll come back to the reasons why, because they're based on what I'm trying to talk about in the book. The real questions, you know, that we're struggling with on this, for me as an activist, I'm asking why is it taking so long to mobilize people when there's such a strong scientific opinion on this? You know, I've been waiting for 25 years, and at every point I just keep thinking, okay, it's just going to be another report, or it's going to be just another political statement. And of course it isn't. There's something going on whereby the information or the research or the data or the respect for the scientists just isn't carrying us through this. But I'm also very interested to know, why is it that the kind of attitudes that people have are so predictable? Like, we know that kind of people thinks this about climate change. Who is skeptical or doesn't believe in it? Well, this kind of person. We know, I'm sure in your work you've met the kind of people who don't accept climate change. And you could describe to me what they look like. And you know what? They'd be just the same as ones here in Britain. So what on earth is going on there? Especially, a big concern of mine, people of conservative politics and values. People who are not, they're not corrupt people. Many of them are very decent, upstanding people. Straight down the middle of society, supporters of a local community, but they're not accepting this. So what's gone wrong? And I guess I'm between these poles, the people who are passionate about climate change and the people who are very deeply skeptical, I'm actually most interested in the book. I pay the most attention to the people in between, because they're the ones we don't talk about. You know, if you were to go wherever you are in the States and go out into the street and ask people, are you concerned about climate change? You'll find a lot of people saying yes. But if you go out and you say to people, what are you concerned about? Can you list for me the 5, 10 things you think are most important? I can guarantee virtually no one will mention climate change. And I do a lot of focus group work. I know exactly until prompted. But when you prompt people and you say, so we've been talking about a lot of things. Let's just talk about climate change. Suddenly people start saying, oh, that's terrible. That's appalling. I really worry about that. So there's this below-the-surface concern that simply doesn't get expressed. We've got an election running now here in Britain. Nobody is talking about climate change. What on earth is going on? And in Britain, unlike the States, the leader of every single one of our political parties has stood up at some point or other and said climate change is the greatest threat we face. The greatest threat is not appearing on the elections, nor is it appearing in the focus group work, the opinion groups, where people say what they're concerned about. So we've got this constant destructive feedback where people aren't talking about it, the politicians aren't talking about it, the media aren't talking about it, so people are talking about it even less. It doesn't become a political issue. You know the deal, because you guys are all working on this. So these are the questions. I guess to go maybe to the conclusion. Well, actually to say, you know what, the conclusion, the questions are important. Conclusions are always open for discussion. What I want is for questions talked about. So first of all, I want you guys and people in the climate movement to realize that it is not simply about pushing even harder in the same direction we've been pushing for 25 years. I think this requires to take a step back and ask if there isn't some ways maybe we've been doing the wrong things, some ways maybe this is a fundamentally challenging issue. And for me, the answer is that this is challenging. It's challenging because we don't want to accept it. It's also challenging because it's a fundamentally difficult issue for us to get our brains around, which is what I want to talk about. It's so based on anticipation, on thinking ahead and thinking, this is where we're going. And anticipation is actually a form of storytelling. So really what happens with climate change is what we're generating stories around it. If we like the story, if it speaks to us and our values, we accept it when we say, yes, this is a threat. If we don't like the story and we don't like who's telling us or the values or the language it contains, we say no. It is all about the story. And the stories become powerful and believed because they're passed around by people we trust. So I think the first thing which is very important to say is this is not about the science. The science, I agree, is very, very strong. But the science is not what persuades people. What persuades them are the stories they hear from the people they trust. First point.
George, can I interrupt for just 1 second?
Please. Mm-hmm.
I'm getting a little bit of feedback on your voice. And
if you can speak
a tad bit slower, I think we'll be able to pick up all the words. We're just getting a feedback somewhere in the system.
I'm so sorry. Okay. How's it sounding now?
It's a little bit better.
Okay. All right. So let's have a look at the brain psychology of what we think is happening. There are two parallel systems in the brain. There's actually a really fun video up on YouTube called Why We Don't Believe in Climate Science, which is done by PBS but takes its ideas from my book. So do have a look at that, and it explains it in a really nice way. There's a rational side to our brain, which is rational reasoning, and that's the side that climate science speaks to very well. that deals with numbers and data and symbols and logic. That's a kind of higher kind of intelligence that we have. But there's a parallel system which is what really guides us in terms of what we take action on. It's what psychologists would call the affective reasoning. And that's based on things which are close to us, things we've experienced before, things which we haven't experienced but they look a bit like things we've experienced before. The signals we get from the people around us, our family, our friends, and the story we tell. And stories have a life of their own. So we have these two sides to our brain. I think what's important to say is that it's that second side which dominates. And by the way, this is theory which is now in the textbook of anyone doing a cognitive psychology degree. This is very well established. And actually, with brain scanning, you can even see how different parts of a brain respond to different kinds of information. The problem we have with climate change is that the science speaks very well to that numbers and data, that rational side. But we have problems with the side which is the affective side, the side which motivates us. One of the people I interviewed for the book was a Nobel Prize-winning cognitive psychologist, Daniel Kahneman. And Kahneman pointed out that climate change contains things which his research show are very difficult, that it appears to be based in the future, that it appears to be uncertain, and that it involves costs. Not only that, but it involves certain costs now against uncertain costs in the future. So it's balancing a cost now against a greater cost in the future. And all of his research shows that this is the worst combination. In fact, he was very nice about it, but he said, I'm very sorry, he says, I can't see any hope on this. So that's what a cognitive psychologist says, but there's actually something which is interesting, which challenges that, which is to say, you know what, when you ask people who you think climate change will affect, the number of people who think it affects them personally, this is in America I'm saying here, is 20%. But if you ask them, do you think it'll affect your local area, then a third of people think that. So somehow, what are they thinking there? That they're sitting in a bubble and it won't affect them? When we ask, so will it affect America as a whole, then it's over half of people think that. The world as a whole? Well, sometimes we're up to two-thirds on that. So what happens is that it's not as if it's something that people can't engage with. They make it something they can't engage with. This is where we start coming back to the story. So we might think, oh, people can't deal with it because it's in the future. No, people put it in the future. They say it's in the future so they don't have to deal with it. They say it will affect other people so they don't have to think about it. Well, of course, as we know, they create an entire storyline that says that it's a myth created by people. It's this point I'm making that this creates anxiety and people try and push it away at arm's length. And there's no single mechanism on this. It's actually a bit like the climate mechanism itself. It's like that one thing presses another thing, affects another thing. People don't talk about it with their friends, or they have a negative attitude with their friends and their family. That makes them express that to other people. That then gets picked up in the media that they listen to and so on. So let's take a few conclusions from this in terms of your work. First of all, I think it's the conclusion that this fundamental structure around stories is very important. We respond to stories about things that are here and now, that there's a very clear threat, that it's things which are visible, that it's things that we might have experienced before. So, for example, Ebola is very big in the media at the moment because it's got very powerful story. It's very upsetting. What's interesting, though, is that when you have competing stories, the dominant one will come to the surface. So, for example, the media, even here in Britain, The Guardian says we'd love to cover climate change more. But they don't, because their front page is covered by the stories that demand attention here and now and so on. One of the key problems with this is that climate change doesn't seem to have an enemy. So people respond very strongly when there's an enemy. Of course, we know people are very motivated and concerned about terrorism or about Islamic State, because this is a very visible enemy. It's an enemy that for many people, especially on the right, is a familiar enemy. And people project things onto this enemy formulation. And we have a problem with climate change. And it's always a challenge which I put to activists, including, I'm sure, many of you, who want to make oil companies the enemy. And I said, well, yeah, they're seriously negligent. They do some seriously bad things. They fund climate change denial. But we have a bit of a problem there because we do use their products. We consume what they produce. We all, through our lives, through our flights, through our cars, through just putting food on the table for our families, heating our houses, we're not intending to cause harm, but we are causing harm. So morally, this is a very difficult issue to communicate. It's like, it doesn't have an enemy, it doesn't have an intention to cause harm, but we're doing it. And that's why, because we're so drawn towards stories, we have a bit of a problem, which is we tend to create stories and insert enemies into it. So the story I tell in the book, for example, is if we found out North Korea was causing climate change, we could be pretty sure we'd have no problems responding to it. It wouldn't be about cost. It wouldn't be about whether it was in the future. It'd be clear. It'd just be North Korea. And, you know, Democrats and Republicans would unite in terms of taking action. What happens if climate change, though, because it's complex, is that people insert their familiar enemies. So in the book, I talk about a crazy, I mean, truly crazy time I had with the Mid-Texan Tea Party. Just really, like you do, I really like this way that you kind of try to respect people. And I respect their energy and their drive and their determination to change things. I told them so. But for them, I'm the enemy, people like me. They told me that climate change is invented by liberal environmentalists with the purpose of increasing the size of governments and taking away our freedoms. In other words, the story has taken over. And there's an important thing in human psychology which is called confirmation bias. That's to say, if you already believe something, you start collecting more information to support it. So if you think that's what's going on, then you believe that scientists are trying to cheat us to get bigger grants. Or you take hold of any little piece of information you can to support the storyline that your enemy is trying to take something away from you. But, as I point out, those of us on the environmental campaigns are doing the same thing. We are creating a simplified story which contains our enemies, which include, unfortunately for many environmentalists, conservatives. So we write off a large part, probably the majority of the population, as we say, oh, these are our enemies, they're fools, they're dupes of the oil industry are our enemies. I don't disagree with parts of this story, but I recognize that we're also taking this difficult storyline and inserting our own enemies. Okay, I have a few more minutes, so I'll take them quickly. Here's another observation. The observation is that there is a non-story. I really want to say this to you, that there's the story we tell, but there's also the story we don't tell. You know, a third of people in surveys cannot recall the last conversation that they had on climate change. In fact, they can't recall having ever talked about climate change with anyone in their entire lives. In the book, I interviewed somebody who was the world's leading expert in silence, socially constructed silence. And he says that's what climate change is. That it's not just something we're not talking about it, we are actively not talking about it. So we're actively shutting it down. And I think, therefore, as activists, we need to recognize we need to get out there and make that conversation happening. Weirdly, I think disturbingly, it's rather like the silence that you can find around human rights abuses. Like in South Africa when they had apartheid, you couldn't talk about apartheid. And if you tried to, people would change the subject. It's the same thing amongst white people, of course. It's the same thing with climate change. If you try and talk about climate change with some people, they shut you up. I try and talk about climate change every single day with somebody I don't know. That's like my... You know, that's me witnessing, as it were, to my belief. Another observation on this is that entire institutions can develop false narratives. And I guess this really relates to what you're trying to work on here, because in the book I talk in detail about how the United Nations has created this complex narrative around market trading of emissions without talking about where fossil fuels come into the system, which is completely bizarre. You know, there's no world trade agreement anywhere, a trade or resource or negotiated international issue anywhere in the world which has a cause of a problem that is ignored and it only talks about the tail end. Like drugs, you don't let anybody grow drugs in their back garden, but you only take action on the people dealing in it. And it's a bit like that of climate change. The whole United Nations system is obsessed with emissions but ignores production, which is actually why your fee and dividend system is so important. It's about transferring to the beginning of the process, not the end. Why do they ignore that? Well, I don't think it's because they've all been bribed by the fossil fuel industry. I think it's because they have the wrong narrative, and then the confirmation bias has fueled that up. I talk in detail about it in the book. So the way that our psychologies work apply right across the board, whether you believe in climate change, whether you reject it, whether you're in the United Nations, whether you're just like somebody filling up the gas at the pump. We're all humans, and I think this is something we all have in common. That's why I think we need to move away from divisive narratives, split up, saying, you know, you're the enemy, and saying, you know what, yeah, we're very different, and we're not going to agree on stuff. You know what, we have a lot in common. So just to finish up and say, the solutions on this, I think, is to say that we can create new stories with new language based around shared and common values. And I love that Marcus Rubio story. I think that really is, I think that's really so strong and so powerful. We can do this, and we need to. A book I'd really love you all to read is a book called Breaking the Chains by Adam Hochschild. Adam, I interviewed him for the book. He lives in San Francisco. And Breaking the Chains starts with how a group of 7 people got together in one room in London and talked about how they were going to close down the most powerful and profitable industry in the world, the international slave trade. And it sounds crazy and impossible, just as what we're doing does, but you know what? They did it. They managed to do it. Within a generation, they did it, and we're going to do this. So just to finish off and say, you know, I'm a campaigner. I'm a radical in many ways. And for me right now, the most radical thing I can do is to talk with people I wouldn't normally talk with. So I am spending a lot of my time talking with conservatives, try to find ways of speaking to their values. That's why I love the work that you're doing, because I think it's so important. And I think that's where the opportunities are. We have to talk to new people in new ways. I'll also say that the great inspiration for me is taken from the religious faiths and the way that they have gone out there and built their movements by going out there, talking to people, explaining things, standing by them. I have an article in The Guardian today. Do please go to The Guardian website, called What the Climate Change Movement Can Learn from Religions. I'm not of any particular faith myself, I have to stress, but I'm very in awe and respectful of how people have managed to build enormous social movements and how much we can learn from them. And again, it's the same thing. Speaking from the heart, speaking of the power of your conviction, and building movements. So just to say, I think that's what you guys are doing. Congratulations.
Thank you, George. Let me start with the first question I got in. This is from our Pasadena Hills chapter from Peter Eisenhardt. He said, you point out that even in the face of climate-related local disasters, people's response is to work together to rebuild their communities rather than acknowledging the underlying cause. What would you suggest are the best ways to tap into this instinct for solidarity in the face of adversity? You know, like, go Team Earth. To motivate action to prevent and mitigate disastrous climate change.
So the first point that what he's saying is I was very surprised. I interviewed people in Bastrop in Texas, a third of a town burnt down in wildfires under record-breaking heat. New Jersey seashore, I interviewed people who'd been hit by Hurricane Sandy just 5 months earlier. Nobody in those places could recall for me a recent conversation they'd had with anyone about climate change. So the silence I was talking about was even present in the places where people had been hit, because they didn't want that story. The compelling story they wanted was how they had all come together. So you're right, incidentally, we've done a lot of work in my own organization, Climate Outreach Information Network, by the way. I'm going to send you guys all an email talking about the reports and things we've written. But we've gone around flood-affected communities in Britain. We find the same thing here. So you've got several things there. When you get an extreme weather event, that is an opportunity to capture people's attention, because climate change is not abstract, it's here and now. But you have a very small window before that opportunity is taken over by people's positive outlook, like let's rebuild, let's look forward. And of course, as we know, it's considered it's a difficult balance, because if you go and you start saying, no, this thing you had, this is climate change, it looks like you're exploiting the situation. So I think there has to be, there has to be a way, many of you I'm sure are invested in your local communities, there has to be a way of saying, I'm a member of a community, my house was flooded, I want to talk about how we prepare and defend ourselves, especially the most vulnerable people in our community, against these future impacts. And this is language I know that speaks well with conservatives. It's defending. You don't even have to talk about climate change and the causes. You can say, look, scientists are telling us, whatever the reason for it, that this stuff is going to get more and more serious. We've all come together around whatever's just happened now, this, you know, this flood or this hurricane. We've shown what a great community we have. So let's start to plan for the future, get the best information we can, think about the people in our community who are vulnerable so we can be ready to protect them when it comes again. So these people are talking about it, because at the moment we just have this silence. So it's breaking that silence around the themes of protection, defending, looking after each other, which we all care about, right?
Great. And George, you're going to be sending me some additional resources to get out into our network. Can you just tell people some of the things that will be coming so they know what to look forward to?
Yeah, so one of the things is that we have already completed now 3 guides on how to talk about climate change with people of conservative values. And you'll notice I say values, not politics, because conservative values spread across. You know, there are going to be plenty of Democrats who have conservative values. Here in Britain, many people, for example, who are from immigrant ethnic communities have conservative values, that's to say very, very traditional attitudes about things. So how do we speak about them? So we've just got one coming out next week for the coming British election on how to do it in the election. So I'll send you guys the links to that. Also some things, how to talk about people, that last question, following extreme weather events. My organization specializes in this kind of practical information, how do we engage with people? And I think it's going back again to that point that I know is, I could say, like, really built into your approach as a, you know, as a movement, which is starting with saying, where are people coming from? What are their values? What gives them a sense of pride? How do I recognize and validate who they are, and how can I build on it? And by the way, what you're doing when you do that is supported by some very strong experimental research that shows very clearly that people are prepared to do that. The thing you also got to do, by the way, when you're going out there and having these meetings with your Congress people and so on, is to really concentrate on the things you have in common. I mean, if any of you out there are Republicans, conservatives, people of faith, put that right in the center of the field. You know, as a Republican Christian, I totally respect your position on these things, blah, 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 blah. And that's why I'd like to talk to you about this thing we might disagree about, because it's that common ground which builds it. So we talk about that, how to build that common ground.
Great.
And I'll send you a link to a bunch of his materials.
Okay.
Also, yeah, also by way YouTube and things, because, you know, it's to be honest, it's a lot more fun watching somebody speak than and listen on a crackly phone.
Yep. Great. Well, thank you. You know, you're welcome to stay on for the next 15 to 20 minutes while we do the second half of the call. And we're, you know, again, I've never had so many people tell me you have to read this book. You know, so great to have you on and get your thoughts. We'll look forward to the additional materials also. We really, really appreciate it.
Oh, thank you. And by the way, the book, I tried to write it. It's very hard to write short, but I tried to write it with short chapters, light, easy to read and fun, because I wanted to write the kind of book that I wanted to read. So there's no graphs in it. it's a good fun read. You should be able to get through to the end of it. Okay, thanks very much for having me on. Thank you.
Thank you so much, George. You know, the first thing that I will speak to is one thing that he just brought up. You know, we measured their party affiliation last year, and we did it again this year. We went from 3% of CCL saying that it was had a conservative orientation to 10% this year. So for, you know, Rob and Grant and Peter and all the people in the Conservative Caucus, really, that's just a great job. And to everybody who's been reaching out, that is an important thing for us to continue to build that part of the organization. And to go from 3 to 10% is absolutely remarkable. Okay, so some of the other things that I want to point to, Amy sent me her monthly report. And what it shows is we had over 180 letters to the editor, 32 op-eds, and 66 meetings with members of Congress and Parliament. So that's a pretty powerful month, everybody, and I appreciate it. I mean, if we had 180-plus letters published, that means that we probably had 3 times that many submitted. So to everybody who was any part of that, that's fantastic. 66 meetings in a month is one of the biggest meetings months we've ever had when it's not one of the conferences or one of our scheduled lobby days in D.C. So for everybody who got meetings with their member of parliament or Congress, great work there. It's just really something good we can build on as we head towards June. Last month we talked about our Farm Bureau program that we've created and that we've got 28 liaisons in for Farm Bureaus. We want 50, obviously. We want one for every state. And the Farm Bureaus are particularly important because agriculture has unique issues. Agriculture is different than everybody else, and there's some things we need to address. And in the typical CCL way, Alex Aminette and Ellie have just created this extraordinary program of building a relationship one Farm Bureau after another throughout the country. The Farm Bureau represents really the kind of conservative interest of farming, so this is a particularly important organization to reach out to. We had 6 briefings with 12 Farm Bureaus over the last 2 weeks. We had Danny Richter, our legislative director, and Scott Nystrom, the author of the REMI report, on those briefings. I thought Danny did a really nice job of positioning the way that those people should be listening to the call, which is don't listen to our policy as our policy, yes or no. Listen to it as it's either this or EPA regulations. So I think that was a nice piece of positioning on Danny's part. And then Scott actually walked them through, region by region, what the impact of our policy would be on farming and agriculture. And that's, again, Alex, Ellie, that was just a remarkable piece of work and something we'll build on. And they've also got a meeting with the National Farm Bureau in June when we're in D.C. Dr. Hansen's going to be attending that meeting with us. So really, really nice a piece of work that's going on there. Salt Lake City, my goodness. Salt Lake City had Dr. Catherine Hayhoe there for 3 days, 3 radio, 2 television, multiple talks, multiple meetings, and I know all of you in Salt Lake know what a great job she did. I also want you to know that from all the notes I've gotten from her, that really lit her up. So I know that Salt Lake Interfaith Power and Light was also heavily involved in that, but for the people in Salt Lake, that is just fantastic, and I really like it when not only do we get people in front of them, but the way it happens that they are so lit up and so inspired by all the meetings that happened and all the work that was done to get them in front of people. All right, I'd like to bring Cheryl McNamara on for just a moment. Cheryl McNamara founded our Toronto chapter and has put together some really great videos over the years that are both kind of fun and enlightening. And she's been working on something for a while that I think is just going to be a great outreach tool for all of us. So, Cheryl, are you there?
Earth to Mark, can you hear me?
Yes, I can. I can. Let me just say one thing about Cheryl before she starts talking. Cheryl's always one of the most prepared people we have and, prepares her laser talks and is ready to go. And she demonstrated last year at the national conference that nobody was ever more ready to meet the president than when she ran him to Chipotle and because she prepared her laser talk, yelled out to him, "I'm from Canada." I don't know how you could more succinctly than that express who we are and what we're trying to do, Cheryl. So, Cheryl, go ahead and tell us about the project you're working on.
Mark, I believe I improved American-Canadian relations in that meeting. Citizens Climate Lobby is recruiting change agents like all of you to sign up for Earth 2. We want you to sign up to stay on Earth to make it livable for generations to come. While 100 people have been selected to train to colonize Mars, we are asking the rest of humankind to sign up for a very important mission. Help transition away from dirty fossil fuels to clean energy by 2050. A key driver in this transition is an effective price on carbon. Part of your Earth 2 training involves lobbying your elected officials for the best carbon pricing mechanism out there, carbon fee and dividend. I am sure you're figuring out by now that Earth 2 is essentially a recruitment campaign for CCL. When folks sign up to stay on Earth, they are signing up to support the work of Citizens Climate Lobby and are invited to join the introductory call, become active volunteers, and or make a donation. Earth 2 officially launches on April 16th, the week before Earth Day. Starting today, CCL volunteers are invited to test ride the campaign. We invite you to sign up at earth2.org and submit a short video selfie in the form of your URL or short written statement explaining why you are committed to making the Earth livable and why you want to stay. Facebook. We created an Earth 2 event on the main CCL Facebook page. You are invited to join the event and include your selfie URL or written statement. We want to get as many selfies and written statements on the Facebook Earth 2 event in time for the April 16th launch. And remember to send your selfie or statement to your elected officials as well, explaining Earth 2, of course. On the week of April 13th, we will post on CCL Community support materials for Earth 2, including a customizable press release to go out April 16th, to localize it, you can localize it, an email sample to send to your network to get them to sign up, a flyer, and a sign-up sheet if you are planning Earth 2 events. Now, I must thank the Earth 2 mission team, Stuart Collins, who created the logo and is editing the Earth 2 video that will be ready for April 16th, Kelsey Jenkins and Tony Cerna, who are helping with the website, Susan Higgins for helping me shepherd the campaign, and Steve Vault for his awesome feedback and support, and to Barbara Wilson as well. So on April 16th, please start inviting folks to join Earth 2 when the website is fully ready and we have a video. Mark, back to you.
Okay, fantastic, Cheryl. Let me just say, while Cheryl's on and the work Kathy and everybody's done, Canada is absolutely on fire right now. I think we've had more mentions on the floor of Parliament in the last month than we've had in the previous 4 years. And Bruce Heyer has championed carbon fee and dividend in the House of Commons. Remarkable. British Columbia had a big climate event with Tom Rand, with tons of media hits. The mayor and member of parliament, Alex name was there. Laurel in Montreal, Kathy and Lars in Toronto had their climate questions read aloud on the floor of the Senate. So things are really happening up there, and everybody up in Canada, I want you to know, I'm aware of it. It's fantastic. Also, last month was the first time we've ever been mentioned in Good Housekeeping. So if you could send them a note, I mean, that's just the kind of publication we've never been mentioned in. And if you would send them a note thanking them for covering climate change, we are expecting that the magazine is going to get some pushback from some people. So if we could love them up a little bit, that would be really, really good. Then the last report I want to report on, you know, last November we had two REMI briefings, one in the House, one in the Senate. In the House briefing, it was a 60-40 split with 60% of the people being, the Senate was 60% Democrats, 40% Republicans. In the House, it was 70% Democrats and 30% Republicans. We just had another REMI briefing in the House in March, and it was a 50-50 split between Republicans and Democrats. That's remarkable, and anybody who was part of inviting people to attend that is really important. Great work. Congratulations on that. Okay, so what are we doing this month? First of all, in Canada, we're going to be working on doing some outreach in the private sector. We're going to ask people to continue to sign the parliamentary petition, specifically asking for free and dividend, and then get ready and organize for all of our Earth Day events. Similarly, Steve Balk, if you could come on for a second. Earth Week, Earth Month, Earth Day, whatever you want to call it, is always our biggest opportunity to get published. So we most Aprils get the most op-eds we get every single year. So, Steve, could you just tell us a little bit about how we should take advantage of this month and any tips you should give us to make sure we get as many pieces published with op-eds and letters to the editor as possible?
Okay, great, Mark. So, as Mark was saying, April is a big month for us with media. There's very few times when we can circle a date on a calendar and say, we can get an op-ed published on this date, but April 22nd is one of those times. So what we're asking folks to do this month is to have someone in your group draft and submit an Earth Day op-ed. And newspapers usually schedule their op-eds out about a week in advance, so you'll want to get it submitted probably the middle of to the end of this coming week in order to get considered for Earth Day. Now, one of the reasons why the newspapers are going to be interested in our op-eds is because typically an Earth Day op-ed will say something like, oh, let's make everyday Earth Day by recycling and saving energy, which is nice, and there's nothing wrong with that. It's just that it's not very newsy. And so what we have to offer the newspapers is an Earth Day op-ed that actually has an element of news in it. And there's lots of stuff going on. The president just submitted the U.S. commitment to the climate treaty that's going to happen in Paris later this year. Pope is coming out with an encyclical. All kinds of things happening in the news around the issue that's going to make it interesting for newspapers. So in this month's action sheet, we have a sample outline to get you started. I would even suggest that you might want to make your op-eds as local as you can. There's things that you can do to do that. You could talk about the local impact of climate change. You could talk about the economic opportunity that there might be in your area with renewables and so forth. So, again, Earth Day is one of our best opportunities for op-eds. Please take advantage of it.
Okay, fantastic, Steve. Thank you for that. Also, we're asking people, you know, we want you to regularly be writing your members of Congress and Parliament. We put some tips on how you could write them, particularly about the REMI study, asking them if they'd seen it or not. And then the third action I want to talk about just for a moment, this is important. So we want you to start scheduling appointments for June now. And we are going to do something a little bit different this year than we have for previous conferences. We are going to try and get an aide from every member of the House and Senate confirmed now. That means you don't have to go through the scheduler. You go directly to the aide. So we'll start asking for face-to-face appointments about 6 weeks out from the conference. We know both from our own experience and from studying how Congress works that once you get in the 6 weeks frame is when you're more likely to get a response that, yes, in fact, the meeting's going to be with a member. It's not that we want to turn down a meeting with a member right now. We would absolutely take a meeting with a member, but we know that usually we're not going to get those locked in until a little closer to the conference. But we do want you to start asking for the meetings with the aides. You would start with anybody you met with last year. If you hadn't met with someone last year, in a Democratic aide, it would usually be the environmental aide. In a Republican office, it would usually be the energy aide. But it might be the tax aide also. So it's not a perfect science. You have to just make sure that you ask and get someone nailed down. We will then, 6 weeks before the conference, begin to ask for the face-to-face with the members of the House and Senate. Now, in order to have 535 meetings and to have those meetings be as effective as they can possibly be, the one piece that must be in place at this point is we need to know who's scheduling the meetings. Most groups have confirmed back to us that we know who's scheduling the meeting because the person who's scheduling it has told us so. So if you've responded to an email saying, yes, I'm the person scheduling the meeting, I'm doing it, that's great. But if you've gotten an email like that and you haven't responded either yes or no, please do that and do it ASAP. What we need to know at this point is who's scheduling what meetings, because what happens is if there's any districts where we don't have a scheduler, we have the interns go ahead and make those appointments, and we don't want to do that if a constituent can do it, which is always better. So
Mark, this is Amy. Can I add one thing to that?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, if they've responded to an email to me, and again, if you have responded to me, Amy Bennett, great. If you have not, that's where I would love to get that confirmation directly to me.
Exactly. Thank you, Amy. And then let me just say also that Amy's email address is on the action sheet. So if you're sitting there today and you go, I never got an email from anybody, but I know I'm scheduling the appointment, we would like you to send that note to Amy right now. So, and that may be, you might be scheduling an appointment, but you're not even coming to the conference. We still need to know that. So the most important thing is having someone in district and then making sure that we get that information into the office. Okay, Amy, anything else I missed there?
No, great, Mark. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. All right, so everybody, yeah, this is, you know, what we are going to try and do is something we've never done before. In previous years of the conference, we've handed everybody their schedule on Sunday night. Why we're trying to work further in advance with everything is we would like to actually get you your schedule a few days before the conference, give you access to the bios, give you a chance to actually talk to the groups of people you'll be lobbying with ahead of the conference if it's possible. It might not be possible, but that's why we're trying to do everything to make sure that every single meeting is as prepared and as effective as it can possibly be. We can't predict who the right person at the right time is going to be, so we have to prepare as if every single one of those 535 meetings is the most important meeting any of us ever attended. Okay, what I'm going to do is I'm going to unmute everybody's line, and if you want to yell out a thank you either or both to Jay Butera for being brilliant with Rubio's office again, for our great guest, George Marshall, that would be fantastic. Hold on a second, everybody.
Great.